I'm Sayer, and I love Marvel.
And I'm Kaylee, and I love someone who loves Marvel. In season one, we watched through all of the Infinity Saga in release order.
For Kaylee's first time.
And Sayer's 85th.
Now for season two, we're watching phase four, both of us with fresh eyes.
Sayer as a super fan.
And Kaylee as a new per fan.
No, cut that.
Welcome to MCU.
And me! Okay, we got it, we got it, we got it, we got it. Today we're talking about 2021's Loki, Episode 5. And here's your spoiler warning.
Wow, that was so packed with so many Easter eggs.
Yeah, you were very excited. I mean, so was I, but I didn't think to stop and slow down and go back and things like that, but you wanted to pause, go back.
Every bit of garbage was a little Easter egg. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's such nerdy detritus.
That's the perfect way to put it. I mean, the people designing this episode must have had so much fun. And some things hold no bearing on the future of the story. Like, for example, at one point, there was a giant helmet of Yellowjacket. He was the villain in the first Ant-Man.
Oh.
There was also Red Skull's escape ship from the first Captain America.
Oh.
Remember that little rocket ship with like the spinning propeller? Anyways, just little things like that.
There was a helicopter that had the word Thanos on the side.
Yeah, and that's a deep cut to the comic books, where in a comic book line, in part of Thanos' journey, he was seeking out one of the Infinity Stones by traveling around in a helicopter.
Right. And then there was a version of Thor's hammer that was seemingly buried underground with a bunch of what looked like cafeteria trays.
Yeah.
Or like cutlery drawers.
Totally, yeah. And then next to Mjolnir was a little specimen jar with Throg inside. And Throg is Frog Thor.
I mean, it is such fan service in a great way. I mean, to me, it's just a feast for the eyes, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of an interview with Michael Waldron that I passed on to you. I think it was in Vanity Fair. He talked about the delicate balance of honoring fans without alienating newbies.
Right.
And how apparently he's working on a new Kevin Feige Star Wars project.
Mm.
And that, for me, will be really, really interesting because I'm a pretty devoted Star Wars fan. But Michael Waldron talks about how it really is a delicate game to play to balance the expectations of, like, the super fans who are going to be looking for all the Easter eggs without turning off new people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's done that really, really well in Loki. When I saw the purple cloud, I went, it's Agatha!
Totally.
Or you know who I actually thought of was Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character? Because Val, because she's had the purple in her hair.
Sure.
And I'm going, are they trying to signal something here with having Agatha in WandaVision and Val in Falcon and Winter Soldier and both the like glimmers of purple?
That's a really good point, actually. We have had symbolism of the villain portrayed in purple in all three of these shows. And I wonder if that means anything. I wonder if that's just an accident. I wonder if it's a purposeful aesthetic choice just for having a theme. Maybe it's linked to Thanos was the last big bad and he was purple.
Oh. What did the purple Infinity Stone represent?
Power. Hmm. And speaking of Eliath, that was one of the references that does potentially mean something for the future of this series. Eliath in the comics is an entity that was a world-conquering force, and one of the only worlds it was not able to conquer was Chronopolis, which is the city of Kang, who I've said before could possibly be the big bad in this series because he's already been announced for the next Ant-Man film. But more than that, another one of the little Easter eggs hidden in this episode, early on, when we're panning across the city and we see what looks like Avengers Tower, turns out it's not Avengers Tower. Instead of saying Stark or Avengers on it, it has Q-E-N-G. which is Kang Enterprises, which was owned by Nathaniel Richards, and that's an alias of Kang the Conqueror. So that's just one of those subtle hints of like, okay, are they going for Kang being the ultimate bad guy in this?
But then what implications does that have for the Ant-Man film if Kang is also featured in that? Like, does that mean that he would prevail in this series in order to go on to be an Ant-Man? Or would Ant-Man take place earlier in the timeline of Kang or what?
Who knows?
Oh, boy. See, this is the stuff that I leave to you because I do take these very much like at face value and don't try and suppose what it means. So I'm glad that you're around to do that, putting the pieces together. Because if I was watching this in a vacuum and obviously like not going on social media or anything like that, I would have no idea who Kang is. Like it would just not come up for me, obviously. I haven't read any of the comics. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious like what it'll feel like if you're right or if you're wrong.
Well, and that's what I think is so great about what you were saying about Michael Waldron, that the expectation that fans have of these shows, how do you honor that while also making it accessible to other people? And so far, I feel like they're doing a great job because they are hinting at this Kang theory, and they are definitely allowing it to blossom, but it also hasn't been so heavy that if it turns out not to be Kang, it'll be like, wait, but you've been saying this whole time. It's just, this is what certain people are able to extrapolate out of it. This show is wide open for the final episode. Another little thing that I noticed that is just a cute design, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The TVA's weapons.
Yeah.
They look like pencils.
Oh, they totally do. They're sharp on one end and then an eraser on the other end.
The eraser on the other end.
And the eraser erases the people. Oh my gosh, yeah. You're so right.
They're little pencils.
Yeah. Oh, that's cute because it's kind of like so analog.
And it fits in with the 70s vibe and stationary, like Miss Minutes is their mascot.
Okay, so let's talk through then the fact that Renslayer knows that when people are pruned, they go to this place, the Void.
Mm-hmm.
And yet none of the hunters know that. Because when Sylvie self-prunes, Renslayer says to all the hunters who are there in the room where she does that, well, she's dead too now.
Yeah. Good.
And she wants to keep up the illusion
mm-hmm.
that pruning equals elimination.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I found the top of this episode, like there's so much exposition. Of course, we're introduced to like this whole new concept of this like variant purgatory, but I found it pretty clunky.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene, especially between Renslayer and Sylvie, I found quite boring and just undramatic. I felt like Renslayer was too obvious. Like her turn was so obvious. I felt like Sylvie is smarter than that. She would know that Renslayer is not actually on her side.
Yeah, I couldn't decide if the writing is really bad in that scene, if Renslayer is being a terrible performer, if Gugu Mbatha-Raw was giving a bad performance. I couldn't decide why is this sudden turn so bad? Are we meant to see how bad it is because, oh yeah, she's going to betray Sylvie again? Or was she actually showing some of her cards going, I am confused by this and I do want to know who's at the top, which I can buy that, but her performance was such a sudden switch from being very committed at the end of the last episode to suddenly going, I'm willing to work with you, Sylvie.
Yeah, I almost wish that like right off the top, if she was going to turn and betray her again, like she does, if she was very on Sylvie's side, like if there was kind of like more desperation. And I wish that the stakes were higher.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell if they were going for Renslayer just discovered the timekeepers are fake, or she has known the timekeepers are fake for a long time, and now is her opportunity to team up with somebody to find out who is actually at the top. If they were saying that the end of episode 4 was the first time Renslayer realized the timekeepers are fake,
mm-hmm.
I did not see any of that shock in her at all.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's kind of like she was playing the middle ground, like not going far enough into the shock and awe of the discovery and like everything I've believed in is fake and a lie, and I want to get to the bottom of this. Because she did say later she wants to find out who's running the TVA.
Mm-hmm.
And I get like the conflict of being like, I have to keep upholding this thing that I have believed in and dedicated my whole life to.
Yeah.
I get that. And I felt like we could all sense from a mile away that she was going to turn again. And I just wish that we hadn't been ahead of it.
I was just thinking, I could see Renslayer actually knowing everything that is going on. She's still kind of feigning ignorance to everyone, because it's not that she needs to find out who's at the top. It's that she wants to get who's at the top. She knows who's there, and she wants to get to them, to talk to them, to save them, to I don't know what. Because in the comics, Renslayer is a romantic partner of Kang.
Oh, okay.
So if Kang is going to be who they're going for in this, then I could see Renslayer maybe had a previous relationship with him at some point, and then they broke up and she was relegated to this job at the TVA. And she wants to get back to him, she wants to plead with him, she wants to get revenge on him for abandoning her there.
Hmm.
I could totally see that. Because I liked the scene between Renslayer and B-15, when B-15 is imprisoned, when they're talking about figuring out who is at the top, who is behind the timekeepers. And B-15 says the difference between Renslayer and Sylvie is that Renslayer wants it, Sylvie needs it. And I think Renslayer wants it because of something she already knows.
Hmm.
I don't think she's driven by curiosity. I think she's driven by something else. So if that's the case, then I think I will look back on this performance and go, okay, that makes sense a bit more. You were trying to just take advantage of these situations to play people around you to get to your end. I will look back and go, ah, I see the acting you were going for.
Mm, interesting. Yeah.
Because if you compare Renslayer with Mobius, when Mobius started to discover that this was all a lie, I really bought what he was going through.
Yeah.
But when Renslayer seemingly discovers that this is all a lie, I go, this is not a shock for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You seem way too cool about this.
Mm-hmm. You know what I really liked off the top was the upside down camera work.
Yeah, very cool.
It was really interesting. And I keep forgetting to mention how much I've loved the tiny detail of the hourglasses that the motif in the TVA that's like on the elevator doors, and it's kind of everywhere in the decor of the TVA. And I really like that.
Yeah.
There's something about it being hourglasses, not that it's just about time, but that hourglasses, especially upside down and sideways, like if an hourglass is sideways, you can stop it. If it's like turned upside down, it starts again. Like no matter which way you turn it, it's like you can just keep time going in a way. And I like that. Instead of it being like an analog clock or digital clock, it's an hourglass.
Yeah.
But also, maybe this is something that only certain people would pick up on, but the hourglass looks a lot like the Jesus fish that's on the back of people's cars.
I think that totally makes sense. It's this doctrine, it's this cause that people have bought into without knowing what's really at the top.
Well, that's why it like stands out to me.
Yeah, that's great.
I definitely enjoyed the parts of the episode that took place in the void more than the TVA in this episode.
Yeah.
But I still did find that there was some clunky exposition when Loki arrives in the void. And I get that they were almost trying to be a little self-aware about it.
This is the void. That's Eliath. We have to go.
Yes, exactly. It is a bit cheeky. And oh, but I was going to ask, what does it mean that there are so many Loki variants there? And the only non-Loki variant that we encounter is Mobius. Why is Mobius there? Why aren't there other variants of other people? Why is it only Loki variants?
I think there are other variants. We saw a bunch of regular human variants show up on the ship when that arrived.
Oh, true, true, true.
But it's like Richard E. Grant Loki says, we survive. And that's what our Loki says to Sylvie.
Mm-hmm.
We may lose, but we don't die, we survive.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Lokis do. I think they are wily, they're smart, they're feisty, and so in a place like this, they are going to thrive. They are going to collect together, and then President Loki seemed to have some Loki variants on his side and other just marauders as well, so they are going to attract people as followers.
It is interesting, like, when our Loki says, this is a nightmare, he's having to face all the qualities of himself manifest in other people.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of that, you know, thing in therapy or any kind of, like, spiritual work where they talk about, like, whatever the trigger is that you find in somebody else is actually a mirror of something in yourself that you have trouble with, or, like, those things that trigger us about other people and that we want to change in other people is the thing in ourselves that we wish we could change.
Yeah. And he's mentioned before, when they were on Lamentis, he said about Sylvie, now I understand how Thor felt.
Yeah. And, okay, I really liked when classic Loki, Richard E. Grant, tells our Loki how he escaped Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
That he went into isolation and he realized how much he missed Thor, and that was his Nexus event.
Yeah.
I thought it was so interesting because by the end of this episode, classic Loki, in a beautiful way, sacrifices himself.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't sacrifice himself to Thanos and instead conjured a beautiful projection of himself and escaped.
Yeah.
But in kind of a full circle moment, he does sacrifice himself. Mm-hmm. It's almost like classic Loki comes to realize that his survival mechanism that let him live longer than most of the other Lokis who've come to this void was not worth it, because the sacrifice of at least trying to do something to stop Thanos and thereby being killed, his escaping that and avoiding that sacrifice meant that he was just living out the rest of his days alone and kind of restless and depressed.
Yeah.
It seems. So much so that he created a Nexus event to reunite with his brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he refers to Loki as the god of outcasts.
Yeah.
And I think there's, like, something that our Loki is coming to realize in that, yes, like, we survive, like, we Lokis, you know, we don't die. And that throughout the Infinity Saga has been the case. Like, we keep thinking he's dead and he's actually not. But is that the point? If you can survive, but you're alone and miserable and restless,
mm-hmm.
is it worth it? Would it have been better to sacrifice and bear all and show love? It's such a meaningful death. Like, to Thanos, it doesn't mean much, but to Thor, it does.
Yeah.
I thought the most beautiful aspect of this episode was that classic Loki ends up having to sacrifice himself, and he's lived out all these days, he's got all these lines on his face, and he's old, and then yet he's the one who sacrifices himself and conjures Asgard.
Yeah.
As a distraction.
I thought that was beautiful. Paying full circle homage again to that initial sacrifice he didn't make for Thor. He conjures up Asgard, this past and this belonging he used to have. I agree. I loved that moment. I thought that was my favorite part of the episode. And it also clinched for me why our Loki and Sylvie's relationship is so important and what it actually is.
Please tell me, because it was so uncomfortable to me.
For sure. And I struggled during that scene too, when they were sitting and there was the blanket and they were talking about what would they do after this. So I'll get to why Richard E. Grant is important in a second.
Okay.
So with that scene when Loki and Sylvie are sitting together talking, I think that outwardly to us, and especially to the TVA, like, Mobius picked up on it and said, how narcissistic of you to fall in love with yourself. I think to everyone outside Loki, of course it's going to look romantic. But to Loki, to somebody who does have so much self-loathing and has never had a genuine affection for anybody, any flicker of caring for somebody is going to look like you love this person. In that conversation, Sylvie said, I don't have friends. Our Loki has never had friends either.
Hmm.
I think Mobius is maybe the closest thing after Sylvie, but Mobius is more like a comrade in arms. Whereas Sylvie, to our Loki, is someone who genuinely understands him, and he genuinely understands her. So there is this bond between them that I think transcends anything romantic, but because they've never experienced anything like this, when they talk about it, it reads as romantic because they are awkward and stilted in their speech about it. I still find it frustrating that the show is leaving it kind of ambiguous, that you could interpret it as a romantic relationship, because I think that's really cheap.
Well, yeah. And like how the music sounds when they're about to reunite, when they drive up in the car and he runs towards her. It's like this romantic music, sitting there with the blanket, holding hands, and then like interlacing fingers to make it even more powerful sort of thing. Like it's screaming for us to think that it is romantic. And I'm not saying it would ruin this if it's romantic, but it just feels like obvious or trite. But what I do appreciate, if they are going in that direction, that it's love, like it doesn't have, there's so many different kinds of love. It doesn't have to just be sexual. It's self-love, you know? And so when Mobius says like how narcissistic to fall in love with yourself, you know, in therapy or like any kind of work that's internal, it is about like self-compassion. And so like Loki seeing something in a version of himself that is worthy and precious and beautiful could be a mirror to him. Like how all the other variants of Loki are so annoying or violent or narcissistic, and he hates all these things, to find a version of himself or like a variant or a Loki that is worthy of his love and care and attention and partnership is actually kind of beautiful if we're looking at this metaphorically. It still makes me uncomfortable. And I found that scene with the blanket, like, okay, let's move on.
But that scene where Loki runs towards Sylvie when she gets out of the car, I thought that was so beautiful because I didn't think it looked like running to a loved one. It looked like running to a friend.
Hmm.
Like, I'm so excited to see you. You're alive. I'm alive. We're here together.
Hmm.
That's why I think it's so important when Sylvie says, I don't have friends, because I think the love that is being shared between them is the deepest form of friendship and kinship and caring that maybe any Loki has ever had.
Hmm.
So, going back to on Lamentis, when they did have that Nexus branch veer off so steeply that the TVA thought stemmed from when she touched his arm and they thought, oh, are they falling in love with each other? No, I don't think that's what it was at all. Maybe it could have been what I said before, that they were literally about to die from the apocalypse. But I think more than that, it was a Nexus event because this was a form of self-acceptance that a Loki has never had before.
Hmm.
And at the end of this episode with Richard E. Grant, when he starts conjuring Asgard, Sylvie says, how is he doing that? Loki says, I think we're more powerful than we know.
Hmm.
And then they link hands together and work together to charm Eliath. Them linking hands is what gives them the power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So when Sylvie first touches Loki on Lamentis, that's the timeline going, these two are going to discover how frickin' powerful Loki actually is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If these two continue to work together, Loki will realize his full potential.
That's really interesting. It kind of brings up for me when Sylvie says on Lamentis that she's no longer a Loki, she could represent the denial of self. She's been running from it for so long that she's like, don't call me that anymore. You know, I don't want to lay it on too thick with like what I said last week about it being this like queer metaphor. But if it is like not just a queer metaphor, but a metaphor for any kind of diverging from any normative path or mm-hmm. whatever society's norm is, that Sylvie has been outcast and running for so long that she's denied that she's even a Loki. And when she says she doesn't have any friends, it's almost like of her own doing, but also because of what they've done to her.
Mm-hmm.
And refusing to be identified with how you were raised or whatever.
Yeah, choosing your own identity.
Yeah.
I've been wondering about Sylvie's Nexus event too when she was a child. And looking at that scene again, she is playing as the Valkyries saving the day. So her Nexus event could have been her first aspirations of being a hero.
Hmm.
When in the sacred timeline, Loki's purpose is to be the villain. I thought it also could have been maybe right before that scene, she was boy Loki. And then because Loki is who they are, boy Loki transfigured into a female version of Loki and started playing. And then the TVA stepped in.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because Loki says to the other Loki variants, have you ever met a female Loki? Mm-hmm. And they say, no, that's crazy. That sounds terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
So ostensibly, she's the first.
Yeah. And then I also liked the line, is he a coward or is he being brave?
That was Richard E. Grant again.
Yeah, I loved all of his lines in this episode. I mean, Richard E. Grant uses language so well. He's just such a seasoned actor and brings such like depth and gravitas to every character. So I loved his classic Loki. I'm sad he's gone in one episode.
I know.
Oh, I loved the scene when Mobius picks up Sylvie in the pizza car. And Sylvie says to him, "You're turning on the very thing you devoted your life to." And he said, "It's never too late to change."
Yeah.
Oh, that got me. It's beautiful. And I think at the end, like when he goes back through the time door,
mm-hmm.
who knows what he's going to find there.
Yeah.
And he's like the only person against this whole entity of the TVA. And how do we feel about Miss Minutes? Because she seems to be answering to Renslayer.
Yeah, I'm still thinking Miss Minutes, first of all, knows everything that's going on and is also hiding stuff. I think Miss Minutes is playing subservient to Renslayer still. I think that there is going to come a point when Renslayer asks for something, when Miss Minutes is going to say, "I don't think so," and denies her and starts to have some agency of her own. If Miss Minutes came up with that plan to stall by inventing a fake ship to look for, then Miss Minutes is more than just a computer program doing people's bidding. Maybe there is actually a void ship too, because in the comics, Kang did have a spaceship that was able to travel through time. Ooh, and we got to talk about Natalie Holt's score.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there were a lot of great variations on the Loki theme in this.
I loved the one with the big Loki fight.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a rock version.
Yeah. Kind of junky rock, kind yeah. of carnival-y as well.
Yeah.
But she uses the bum, 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 bum. That motif is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end, when they were fighting Eliath, she referenced Ride of the Valkyries again.
Mm.
Bum, 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 bum. Ba-bum, ba-ba-bum. It kept using that same
right.
riff.
Like, bum, ba-ba-bum, bum, bum, ba-ba-bum, bum. You mean that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
She's using that as a main theme.
Yeah.
Which links to Ride of the Valkyries being about gods going into a final battle, but also young Sylvie playing as the Valkyries winning the day.
Mmm. Ooh, I like that.
And there's also a neat little tie-in of nine symbolism. So especially in the credits, there is the number nine everywhere. And the number nine has been in the show as well.
Oh, and you think there's going to be nine episodes.
I don't know what nine is referencing, but the original song, Ride of the Valkyries, is in 9-8. Bum, bum, ba, ba, bum, bum. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Whoa.
So I'm like, what is 9? Why is it important?
Interesting. What does 9 symbolize?
Well, in Norse mythology, 9 was a very magical number. The 9 realms of Yggdrasil.
Mm-hmm.
It could mean that there are 9 episodes. That would be crazy if next week we watch an episode and it leaves on a cliffhanger and the story's not done. And we're like, what?
That would be such a Loki move.
It would be. I think I'm 40% certain that's going to happen. No, 40%. I'm 30%. 30%.
Yeah, pull it back a bit.
Yeah,
40.
Yeah.
It's a bit cocky.
Yeah, I'm 30.
That would be great.
I'd love it.
But I also feel like, story-wise, it's kind of like climaxing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That's why I'm also 70% not sure it's going to be 9. It means so much when you rate and review our show. It helps us reach more listeners, and it lets us know what you think. You can also follow along online at MCU and Me Podcast. See you next time.